In the cemetery where I practice pedaling, sailing circles around the dead, iguanas sunbake and scurry the white slabs, the green length of them defiant drapery and death's pale pallor. I'm told they're invasive. Even their taxonomy, iguana, iguana, it's too much.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with poet Kaylin Capra Thomas about her debut collection, Iguana, Iguana. As another poet, Diane Seuss, writes of Kaylin's collection, Iguana, Iguana is composed of many slippery selves, the Florida self, Montana self, daughter, lover, kid, adult, the solitude junkie, the working class self, and the kitchen self. All the selves are united in their lack of cloying hopefulness and easy outs, and their awareness of the mortal body, which is also the source of the book's comedy. Diane Seuss is so right. This book is funny and recursive, and perhaps most of all, it's comforting. It's a book about finding and knowing home, wherever and whoever you are. Kaylin Capra Thomas's other works include the chapbooks Inside My Electric City from Yes Yes Books and the Marilyn Letters from Dancing Girl Press. Her poems have appeared in journals including New England Review, Pleiades, Coppernickel, 32 Poems, Hayden's Fairy Review, and many others. The 2018 to 2020 Poet in Residence at Idlewild Arts Academy, she now lives in Columbia, Missouri, where she is a PhD student in English and creative writing. Kaylin, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me, Lauren.
If you don't mind, I'd like to start our conversation off with a reading.
Oh, yeah, I'd love that.
Will you read the first poem in your collection, Passage?
I will, yes.
Also, congratulations on Iguana, Iguana. It's so exciting that there's a full length sitting right in front of us.
Right in front of us. Yes, it's real. Thank you. It means a lot to me. Passage. It's hard to tell what will be important. The river is high again, and so are the teenagers encrusting its edges, beady-eyed and black-clad, sideways glancing, suspicious as crows, each in the cluster a dead version of yourself, one scratching peace signs into the dirt with her toe, one singing ugly, one poking a drowned worm expressionless. And you stand apart, head cocked, remembering that the French for to happen also means to arrive, that sometimes we say deceased when we mean departed. The obscure chorus of your own life keeps cawing into the diamond dark, under the roaring of each body you inhabit, the waters, the others you've flocked to, even when all you can hear are your own hard swallows or the sweet shriek of those far-off trains you suspect are coming to claim you, to lay open the hills you haven't seen.
Geographically, these poems span a very great distance. That movement, what you just read as arrival and departure, is one of the larger threads in this collection. And those ideas sit alongside so many shifting identities. Even in this single passage, there is multiple selves. In other poems, you write of a Montana me and a Florida self. And the speakers in these poems, they define themselves in myriad ways. Would you talk about those movements between places and identities and this resistance that I'm reading throughout this book to stasis?
I think part of the movement comes from the actual movement that was happening in my life. I moved a lot from, you know, the oldest poem in the book is from 2014 when I was here in Montana. And the most recent poems are from being in Columbia, Missouri. And in between, I lived in Cincinnati, Ohio, Gainesville, Florida, and Idlewild, California. And I felt like every time I showed up in a new place, I was recontextualizing myself and I was a stranger in each new place, meeting strangers and having to sort of tell them who I am over and over. And when you have to redefine yourself in a new place so many times in such a short period of time, you kind of become more aware of what has changed from movement to movement, from place to place. I think a lot of times if I stay in one place for a little bit longer, I'm not as aware of the things that I have become and have left behind of myself. But when you have, when it's almost like when you invite someone over to your house and all of a sudden you see your things through their eyes and you're like, what do they think of this like framed picture of a lobster that I have? Like, what does this communicate about me? And so I think that constantly reintroducing yourself, recontextualizing yourself, telling the stories that you feel like are the stories that help somebody know you. You know, like, this is the story that tells you a little bit about my wacky sense of humor, or like, this is the story that tells you about my relationship with my mom. You think about those stories and you think about yourself in a different, through different lenses constantly, so that it becomes, so that your sense of self becomes almost like prismatic. And you're like, I can be a different person in every place. And so, you know, every time I leave a place, I think I'm leaving a little bit of who I was there behind.
In that sense, though, it's not only you yourself changing in different places, but you're a different person with different people in your life too.
Totally.
There's so many different identities. And I think that's one of the joys of this book is you see these speakers inhabiting different roles as they come into contact with different people and different, certainly different places that we've been talking geographically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned this reinventing yourself over and over, which is then a constant repetition. Right?
Yes.
You're constantly reintroducing yourself to people. You're constantly reinventing yourself. And one of my questions for you, I would love it if you would read this poem too, but why Iguana Iguana became the title. And perhaps that's the answer, right? That there is this repetition that happens when you're moving through space. But maybe you can read Iguana Iguana and we can talk about some of the lines in there.
Yeah. And I should say that I wrote this poem in Key West. And that was where I finally got a handle on riding a bike at like 30 years old.
You'd never learned how to ride a bike.
They tried to teach me and it didn't stick. And I was scared of everything as a kid. And just, I could like ride circles in a parking lot, but I didn't like riding on the street or, I was very... I historically have a very fraught relationship with things on wheels. And so there's a line in here about practicing pedaling. And I practiced riding a bike in this cemetery nearby the cottages at the studio of Key West, because that was the primary mode of transportation. So I was kind of like, okay, I've got to get this down now. and then it was very nice. I had a nice time biking around the island. Iguana, Iguana, Key West. Things crawl over me here. No-see-ums and biting ants. They make me feel hospitable. Like, at last, I'm a good host. Stop itching, I tell myself. We have guests. What is a guest, if not something that takes a little bit of your life? In the cemetery where I practice pedaling, sailing circles around the dead, iguanas sunbake and scurry the white slabs, the green length of them defiant drapery and death's pale pallor. I'm told they're invasive. Even their taxonomy, iguana, iguana, it's too much. Too many iguanas, the William Carlos Williams of reptiles, or the man my mother loved after my father, Jim James, who chugged caffeine-free Diet Pepsi and made his pecs dance, recited the three words of Italian he learned from Sylvester Stallone. Ti amo and andiamo. He once argued with me over my stubborn belief that 10,000 was the same thing as 1,000,000. I was never good with numbers. He was never good with kids. He built things and made my mother laugh, maybe too much, maybe for the wrong reasons. During cold snaps, the iguanas freeze and fall like stoned fruit from the trees, wake only once their core has warmed. I won't be here to see it. It's the off-season now, August, everything dank and hot-blooded, which is what I think my mother liked about Jim. Something raw about him, The pink scars where his own mother's boyfriend stubbed out cigarettes on his arms, or how he called "Here, kitty, kitty," nightly into the dark after the cat ran away. She was a stray to begin with. We lured her into our lives with milk, named her Fitty Fat, the kitty cat, let her eat and kill as much as she wanted. Litters of kittens and kibble and dead birds piling up. What else is there to say but everything we've said before, over and again? Iguana, iguana. Italian stallion, here, kitty, kitty, andiamo, Jim James, what is a child, if not something that takes a little bit of your life? He wasn't a bad man. He made my mother laugh.
Why did you choose Iguana, Iguana as the title of this collection? How does this particular poem represent the full collection?
The collection changed a lot from the initial form it took when I sent it to my editor at Deep Vellum, Sebastian Paramo, and the original iteration of it had a totally different title. And so once it kind of came into its final form, that old title no longer served. And so I was kind of looking for things. I had a couple of different ideas. A couple of other poems in the collection were bandied about as potential titles. But I came back to Iguana Iguana because both the title and the poem is so concerned with doubling and self-replication and this idea of kind of everything existing in multiples. And I keep wanting to say multiverse, like the multiverse of my life, but I really don't know what a multiverse is, so I should not say that.
You can take that word and make it your own.
Yeah. It is the multiverse of my life and all of the possibilities. I mean, this poem looks at whereas some of the other poems like Pete and the poem about the Montana self, whereas those poems imagine a sort of an alternate universe. I think that's what I might mean by multiverse.
Okay.
Those poems imagine an alternate self and an alternate universe in which different decisions were made and I wound up staying somewhere. And this poem actually looks at the real particulars of aspects of my life and things that I've experienced and people that I've known. I think that Iguana Iguana wound up sort of representing the multiplicity of the collection, the multiplicity that is sort of inherent in all of these actual real lived details, the multiplicity that is contained in all of the versions of our lives where we made choices other than the ones that we made. So I think doubling, multiplicity, and recursiveness wound up being themes of the collection that I felt like both this poem and the taxonomic name Iguana Iguana represented for me.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with poet Kaylin Capra Thomas. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. If you want to listen to this conversation again or share it with friends, it can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
It's quite lucky, and I want to talk about luck.
Okay.
But before we talk about luck, okay, I would love it if you read a couple of poems.
Great.
Back to back, actually.
Okay.
Will you read Lightning Suspected in Deaths of Horses and then The Window, or just Window, pardon.
Okay. Sure. Lightning Suspected in Deaths of Horses. I want to take you to the black mud spring pasture where 6 horses fell and did not get back up. I don't know if they were dark or dappled. I wasn't there. I read it in a newspaper in Vermont, sitting at the counter of a diner that no longer exists. Lightning Suspected in Deaths of Horses, small article in a bottom corner, not much more information than that. It struck me. I'm not trying to be funny. I carried that headline around until it became a slogan, although I'm not sure what I'd been sold. Maybe this, The sky opens. You kneel and beg its mercy, and it doesn't make one lick of difference. Or maybe light appears, and your life is transformed. Finally getting exactly what you asked for all along. A shift in luck. Sudden brilliance. Your body lit, electric. Your own. Enough to let it go. Window. So many friends I've caught beautiful, not knowing it, cursing me in the snow or fumbling shirtless through cabinets for the last sachet of tea. Their petulance, an unlikely ornament. It is easier, I suppose, to wrap myself in myself, the root of us, alone a lot. So I cook near naked by the kitchen window. I try so hard to get caught. But nobody looks up while they walk home to whatever awaits them. Not me. Not this soup of lemon and leftover stock. Perhaps the television, left on since morning, the newscast too loud, never ending, perhaps a note that says I'm leaving. I've gone out and left the stove on for hours at a time, many times. Somehow, nothing's caught fire. But I know how luck is finite, quantifiable. And this knowledge is an under-the-skin feeling, like being watched. Like being told how lovely I look, bathed in the light of my own life, burning.
I know how luck is finite, quantifiable. So both of these poems speak towards luck, and mm-hmm. they're not the only two poems in the book that mention luck, whether it's luck or its opposite. Mm. When I was drafting these questions, I didn't know the question I wanted to ask. So I'm just going to ask it in a very broad way.
Okay.
What does luck have to do with it?
Mm. Yeah. And now that you say that, that's one of those, you're such a good reader. That's one of those things where I'm like, I didn't realize how much I wrote about luck. But you're right. I think part of it is that I'm very superstitious. And I think I'm superstitious because I have anxiety and I'm just constantly thinking about, like, what can I do to stave off my doom? These random assortment of things that have lodged themselves in my brain as being good luck should help, right? Basically, I have this weird collection of things that I feel like are... Yeah, they're quirks, I guess, but they all come from basically like someone at some point said that it was lucky or unlucky. So, you know, I've got a thing with numbers where I quite like the number 3 and therefore also the number 9 as...
3 times 3 is 9.
Yes. Alicia Mountain once said that it was the 3est of threes.
I like that.
Yeah. And so she's also big into threes. But what does luck have to do with it? My brain tells me everything. Logically, I don't know. I think probably because I think there was sort of like a spiritual vacuum in my life growing up where like I didn't really have a defined system of belief. So I was kind of always trying things on. And I think some of the luck stuff wormed its way into my mind that way.
I just picked you up from a workshop for the Montana Book Festival, and mm-hmm. you mentioned tarot. Well, tarot seems like a system of belief, right?
Yeah.
A way to narrativize one's life in a way that like is easier to understand than like the chaos that they actually are.
Totally.
What other systems, apart from this idea of like good and bad luck, have you used to kind of guide yourself and maybe even like when it comes to writing?
Mm. Yeah. So that workshop that we did was a lot of the prompts were based on like divinatory practices. So we had some prompts for tarot, for astrology, for cartomancy, which is divination based on playing cards, and for runes. And of those systems, I think I've I'm like most personally invested in astrology. I think that definitely, you know, I was reading about it from a young age, and I think that that has also shaped. It's provided me a lens through which I view the world. You know, there are always those people who are like, well, it's not real or it's pseudoscience. And I'm like, okay. But I think that the symbols and the archetypes and the language around some of those practices are really evocative and rich and stimulating. And I really enjoy them. So I don't think that any of that actually makes it into – I think the only poem in here that has – anything to do with that directly would be when I was an alchemist, I discovered nothing. Mm-hmm. And that actually, that poem came out of, I went down to the psychic fair in Hamilton.
Here in Montana?
In Montana. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I've never been.
I can't remember what the store is called, but there's like a shop that sells, you know, like crystals and whatnot. Yeah. And they have a psychic fair, and I went and I had what was called a rose reading, which I didn't know what it was going to be, but apparently it was the reader imagining me as a rose. And she told me that in a past life I had been a wizard slash alchemist, and that I had like a workspace that had a human skull on it. And I was like, that's pretty cool.
do you want to read that poem?
Yeah, yeah.
Give listeners a sense of what you're talking about.
Yes. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. When I was an alchemist, I discovered nothing. The world outside is dead and dark November, the month of my earthly arrival. The Saxons called it Blutmonad, blood month, a time for sacrifice. Inside, I cover eggplant in wet red sauce. Nightshade on nightshade, the spices on my fingertips a fine powdered gold. What gods remain have quit taking bribes. I cut my thumb paring carrots and call it blessing, blessure. Knowledge is a tree, yes, but merely. Twigs stabbing up to bleed the sky. I don't believe in dividing the planet by four. I believe in salting eggplant slices, in leaching bruised, bitter water from their flesh. Who will I thank for this? I am alone in the kitchen, sharpening a knife.
If a poet's job, and I'm going to put job in quotation marks, and you can 100% disagree with me on this, but if a poet's job is to recontextualize language so that readers, if we're talking about a poem that's going to be read, might see it in a new light, new. I'm wondering about the origin of your language. We're the same age, I think. So I'm wondering what words and dictions and sayings and accents sort of populated your life as a child, as an adolescent, that have dictated the way that you write and the diction you use now and the language you use now, the vocabulary. It's a pretty pragmatic book that, like, in general, like, it's like, it doesn't dwell in sadness, though there are some very dark moments. There's plenty of humor. Anyway, I'm tangentially just asking you where your love of language came from.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's another great observation. I'm from New England. I grew up in Massachusetts, and I think that there's just the kind of like irreverent, salty, crusty, like Bostonian, like crusty New Englandishness. I think that that is sort of embedded in my psyche. I think, you know, there is this very like knuckleheaded, roguish sense of humor that is kind of like the base sense of humor in New England. I say New England and not Boston just because I grew up closer to, I grew up in between Providence and Worcester. So those were kind of more my home cities of reference. But yeah, I feel like I come from salty stock, and and they are just they are very weird and funny. And I guess I'm talking about my family now, but yeah, everyone in my family is incredibly weird and very funny and really really invested in narrative. Like my dad will spin a yarn for you as long as that metaphor that fell apart. But my my dad can spin a yarn, and he also is somebody who I feel like, because he repeats his stories a lot, and it's not just because he's getting a little bit older, but he has always done that. And I think that it's because he also expresses himself to the world through story. Like he's somebody who is like, okay, this is – and I don't think he does this consciously, but he has these stories about his family, about growing up in California, and then he's always kind of like adding to the rotation as he moves along. And, you know, thinking that has – when he tells a story again, it just sort of – solidifies it for me that this is a story that's important to him, because he's repeating it, right? Repetition usually communicates, it asks us to pay attention to it. My mom is also somebody who, I mean, she was always just a big reader, and also really loves, like she loves to consume narrative, and is also very — both of my parents are very strange and very funny, and sort of she's someone who sort of like self-mythologizes. Like she's got the stories that she tells about herself are often they feel curated to showcase some sort of like madcap exploit or humor or yeah, so they are, I think my parents and my family at large were kind of big influences in terms of wedding me to language and to narrative. And that was kind of always how I was naturally inclined to express myself. I would, before I knew how to write, I would like dictate things to my dad, and he would like staple them together as little books. And it was actually —
that's incredible.
It was, yeah, it was nice. I found one of them in like a, you know, box in my mom's basement at one point. It was totally nonsensical. It was like, I would illustrate them too. So it's like a blob of crayon, and it's like, the ghost is sad. It's like, okay.
Always with the ghosts.
Always with the ghosts. Yes.
Kaylin, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Lauren, and thank you for having me, MTPR. I love you.
That was poet Kaylin Capra Thomas, and her debut collection of poems, Iguana, Iguana, is available now from Deep Vellum Publishing. Look for more information about Kaylin at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Michael Marsalek engineered this episode. Our artwork was designed for The Right Question by Molly Russell. Our music was written and recorded by John Floridis. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.